This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. For the remainder of the Democratic primary season, and most likely up until November, race will continue to figure at or near the top of the national political conversation. Some of that discussion goes to policy and issues, unemployment, affirmative action, but a lot more centers on our personal experiences, who we see, who we talk to or don't, how honest we are about resentments that have built up over decades, about anger that for many is rooted in history. Over the course of the next months, we'll talk about the issues and the policy differences. Today, though, we focus on how and when and how honestly we talk with each other about race. We'll hear from three people who address these issues on a blog, in a newspaper column, at neighborhood meetings. And we need to hear from you, too. Have you ever spoken honestly about race with someone of another race? What did you learn? Tell us your story. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. You can also share your story on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Dawn Turner Trice of the Chicago Tribune started a blog in response to Senator Barack Obama's call for a national dialogue on race. It's an open forum for people of all backgrounds to discuss their experiences about race, and she joins us now from a studio in Chicago where she's a columnist for the Tribune and mediates a blog called Exploring Race. Dawn Turner Rice, nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you so much.
And I wonder, do you get blogs, do you get posts on your blog that go to the gut level, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. When we started this back, actually, I had the idea back in January, right after Obama won the Iowa caucuses. I mean, we all clearly were very surprised that you have a man of color who did so well in a state that is overwhelmingly white. And I thought that there had to have been something going on in the country. I know that racism is not dead, but we were trying to just explore some of the models for race that we've held dear for many years. And so we started, the actual blog started after a couple of days after the speech, the Philadelphia speech that Obama gave on race. And one of the things that I said from the very, very beginning that it was so important to have people speak openly and honestly about race, and it's something that we don't, definitely politicians, I mean, clearly tap dance around it all the time. And especially at the presidential level, they don't necessarily talk about race. They don't have to. And it's a third rail issue, so why do it? But on our forum, we wanted to have people, we wanted this to be a safe place where people can speak openly and honestly. We didn't want just people preaching to the choir, or we didn't want it to be an echo chamber. We've seen enough of those. We wanted this to be something different. And so far, we've had a diversity of comments.
And I wonder, does the anonymity or relative anonymity of a blog, do you think, foster this dialogue?
It absolutely does. People feel free to say things that they would not ordinarily say in face-to-face contact. And some of the comments are reflective of that, because they could be very, very, they're biting at times. But there is no way that you can separate that. If you want to have an open discussion, you can't say, well, you can say this, but you can't say that. Now, we will take out certain words, maybe the N-word or something like that. But I will, if the word is written out, I'll make it the N-word. I want people, you know, we need to see all of this. For too long, I think, it's been just kind of hidden, and it's been allowed to fester, or people will talk about it in homogenous company. But I like the idea of everybody getting a sense of the good and the not so good.
And what surprised you?
That I think that we have come, I am an African-American woman, I'm 43 years old, and I am the beneficiary of the civil rights movement. I mean, that first generation to kind of get out there and really reap some of the rewards. But I'm amazed that in the year 2008 that there are some people who still feel, who are very bitter. And just are not as open-minded as I think maybe a lot of us should be, a little more open-minded this day and age.
And is that on black, white, or Latino?
Oh, my gosh. It's across the board. I'll give you an example. We had a woman, a Jewish woman, Joanne Cook, who wrote this really brave essay about examining her own prejudices. She moved. She made a conscious effort to move into one of our integrated communities here in the Chicago area. There really aren't many of them. But she lives in Evanston, Illinois. But by the time, so she wanted her kids to grow up in this type of an environment. But by the time the kids got to high school age, she started to question, you know, was she really okay with the black kid coming to the door to pick up her child? And I just thought it was such a brave and courageous essay. And you had black people talking. I mean, some of the comments were just amazing. There were black people saying, well, yeah, Jews are some of the most racist people around. And you had Jewish people talking about black people. I mean, there was a point at which the conversation really started to devolve into something fairly ugly. But the great thing about the comment boards is that there's a self-correcting essence to them. And so you kind of get other people who can jump in and chime in and really steer the ship in a way that is, you know, a little more forward thinking, or at least you kind of, people will ask, well, did you read? Did you really read the essay all the way through? Did you understand the theme or the tone of it? So that's pretty much, people kind of, they are on point sometimes and sometimes they aren't.
Don Turner Trice, a columnist with the Chicago Tribune, who moderates a blog called Exploring Race on the Chicago Tribune website. Let's see if we can get some callers in on the conversation. 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Have you ever spoken honestly with a member of another race about race? And if so, what did you learn? Our first caller is Phil. Phil with us from Forestville in Maryland.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
Yes, I actually am just a little older than your guest. I'm right at 48, 49 years old. And I remember as a kid going into a department store with my grandmother where they forced her to put down articles of clothing and told her either you pay for it or you leave it there. You cannot try this on. But as a little kid, I really didn't understand what was going on until years later, and I grew up and I saw how, you know, people of other communities would treat African-American people, especially in the white community, going to school when I had a chance to go to high school and go to college. And it was just one of those things where when you live in a homogeneous society, you kind of don't think about it, and it's when you come in contact with other people. And I found that if I was honest about the way I felt with my white counterparts, that they would withdraw. I mean, they wouldn't want to talk about it. It was almost like a source of contention for them. And for me, I knew that if I did not learn to assimilate to certain cultures, I wasn't going to progress as a professional. And currently I own my own firm that services an industry, in particular nationwide.
Does that mean
I had to learn how to assimilate? But I don't think that many white Americans, especially in my contemporaries, feel that they absolutely have to.
And does that mean suppressing, your anger?
Well, you know, and here's the thing. Anger, it's kind of funny. Yes, I get angry. And I was telling your producers or the people who answer the phones.
Yeah.
I built a house in Maryland that right around $700,000-$800,000 house. But I came from very humble beginnings. My first P&I payment on my first mortgage when I was 21 years old was $293 a month. Mind you, it's not that now. But the idea is when I went into that house, I bought it at a good time, built it at a good time, and I have a manageable mortgage. I can afford it. I can do all those things. But I've had on three occasions, white people come up and ask me, how much do I charge to do landscaping and cut grass? Yet my neighbor across the street is doing the same to his house, and no one has to ask him. And so I think what happened is it's more of a subconscious type of deal. I don't think people are maliciously or consciously, I mean, you got a few of them out there, but maliciously or consciously racist. I think it's just something that they just never stepped outside of their own cultural comfort zone.
Don Turner writes, this must be familiar ground for you.
Oh my goodness! I keep hearing people say, When I'm reading the comments, the comments are when you're talking about black people or Hispanic people or Asian people, there are these broad blanket statements. And so I think that what people of color fight every day is this invisibility. You don't want people to look at you and then superimpose all of those issues that you may be dealing with race or those perceptions that you have about black people or whoever, just on you. And so this whole idea of racial reconciliation, I mean, wouldn't it be just lovely if people can see people as individuals? And that's I think we're a long way away from that.
Yeah,
but I think that's kind of what the caller is talking about.
Yeah, it's not at a rational level. It's at a subconscious
right.
level. Yeah.
Absolutely. And so even people who see, as I was saying, that Joanne Cook essay, it's people who believe themselves to have evolved or, you know, to not have those same types of prejudices and biases, we all on some level have them. And it's that constant, if you're interested, that constant fight to not engage into some of those thought processes that we're almost as Americans, we're taught from very on that this is how we should think about or see other groups of people.
Phil,
can I make one more last question? I mean, a comment. I'll be very brief.
Go ahead, please.
Raising two sons, I have two sons, one 26 and one is 18. He's just graduating from high school. And my 26-year-old lived a long time in a predominantly African-American community and for probably the last 10 years. In a mixed community, largely white but mixed. But what happened is that I noticed with my youngest son, the schools that he was a part of, most of them were probably 96-97% white, very few Asians or Hispanics, but a few blacks. When they're little kids and they're 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, no big deal. But when these kids start hitting puberty and you start seeing the little girls liking the little boys and the little boys liking the little girls, you see a huge change in the way the parents respond. And in my case, I don't care. I would much rather for my child to find someone that loves them and cares for them. I don't care if they're green. It doesn't matter to me. And my oldest son's wife is from Seoul, Korea, and she's like our daughter because we only had two boys, so now that's our little girl. But the reality of it is that I think the intolerance and I would say, and I'm not trying to put it all in.
And really quickly, if you would, Phil.
Huh?
Very, very quickly, if you would.
Yeah, I'm not trying to put it all in the white community, but I think that other communities of color are a little more tolerant than the white community in general because they have been at this time still the power brokers of this country.
Phil, I'm afraid we're going to have to end it there, but thanks very much for the call. And Dawn Turner Rice, thank you for your time today.
You're very welcome.
Dawn Turner Rice of the Chicago Tribune, whose blog Exploring Race is on the Chicago Tribune website. 800-989-8255. I'm Neil Conan, Talk of the Nation, NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Talking about race is a challenge with coworkers, friends, even inside families. It can be uncomfortable bridging the divide between different groups and experiences. Barack Obama's campaign is focused on open dialogue and racial reconciliation. We need to hear from you. Have you ever spoken honestly about race with someone of another race? What did you learn? 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And you can read what other listeners have to say on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Gregory Rodriguez is a columnist for the Los Angeles Times, director of the California Fellows Program at the New America Foundation, also author of the book Mongrels, Bastards, Orphans, and Vagabonds, Mexican Immigration and the Future of Race in America. He joins us from the Marketplace Studios in Los Angeles, and it's nice to have you on the program today.
Thanks very much for having me.
And is it realistic to think that we can get honest about race?
I think it's realistic to think that we should have a conciliatory attitude toward our racial differences, but I think it's unrealistic to think that we're going to have reconciliation, that I think we've really, really upped the ante now, and the discourse is somehow Obama's speech and its rather facile moral equivalence between his politically incorrect or sometimes politically incorrect white grandmother and Reverend Wright, that led us to believe that there would be this tit-for-tat, that there would be a I'm sorry and a hug on some national level, that and that the millions of incidents that happen on a daily level in this incredibly diverse country would end up in a big group hug. And I think that's not going to happen. And I think it's actually a disservice to think that we're going to reconcile in that way. And I think the first caller, his experience was incredibly poignant and more to what I'm talking about. He had a certain resentment. He has those memories. He has this certain bitterness of the way his grandmother was treated. But at the same time, he seems realistic and about the nature of race in America. And he didn't hunker down. He didn't hunker down in his anger. He moved forward, and he himself lives a very diverse life with a Korean American daughter-in-law and one of his sons in pretty much all white school. So that's what I'm talking about: a sense of realism as to the racial problems of this country and moving forward in any case.
Here's an email we had from Andres. As a Hispanic immigrant, I find there are many barriers to speak openly about race. The main one, in my opinion, is political correctness, which is, in my opinion, also almost a form of censorship. I feel the best way to overcome this misinformation is to speak freely in order to clear stereotypes and free people from common misperceptions that only divide us in terms of race and ethnicity. And you get this reaction to political correctness from, I think people begin to regard it as something that's safe, but awfully vanilla.
Absolutely. It's almost a self-protective mechanism, the political correctness. We know, as Donna Turner Rice talked about her blog, she said it starts off good, but she admitted herself that it often devolves into insults, into this uncontrolled talk. Because we often talk about race, or social scientists do, as if it were this quantifiable reality that we can talk about in terms of numbers home loan mortgage acceptance rates, or we can talk together with leaders of different communities who can shake hands and speak. But it really, again, back to that first caller, this is really about memories and grudges and resentments and long-term pain that this man felt at the way his grandmother was treated. These are things that live on in our hearts. This is much more heartfelt and visceral and real than the way that any politician could ever talk about race, because politicians don't talk in heartfelt ways. They talk in generalities. And they often don't tell the truth. So, I mean, putting race and politics together almost seems counterproductive, or certainly counterintuitive to me.
You've written in your column about real and imagined slights and insults. And obviously the real ones, well, they're going to be hard to resolve. But couldn't dialogue resolve at least the imagined slights?
Well, the problem with dialogue at times is that the man in that shop, and I'm going to go back to your first caller, who mistreated this gentleman's grandmother, is dead. And who do we talk to? Do we talk to the representative of all racist white people, or all potentially racist white people? Who represents whom in these discussions? Most of the time, particularly within the Beltway, we do have spokespeople, but they're self-selected, they're foundation-supported. They're not real spokespeople for anybody. So when I have a grievance against a person who's hurt me, I should talk to that person. I mean, presumably, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not the person who somehow reminds me of that person. I have to. That's what race tends to be. Like, so I came to the studio today, and let's say a Cambodian man mistreated me or flipped me off in my car. Is my problem with all Cambodians? Or is it with this one Cambodian man who I would love to track down right now? That was a joke.
Let's see if we can get some callers in. This is Tammy. Tammy with us from Oklahoma.
Yes. I was just listening to the show, and I work in an office that is prominently African-American, and we're all professional counselors, but yet when you try to bring up any issue that has to do with trying to get a dialogue with race or what have you, there is like a wall there. It's like we don't understand, as far as being Caucasian, what they're dealing with or what's been dealing in the family issues. It's kind of like there's this anger, and they have the right to express it, but we don't have a right to express it back or to actually ask about it. And so there's a lot of anger there of something that we've not done, but yet they have a right to express it back to us, but we have no right to, we have a right to just take it. And so there's not a dialogue. There's not a dialogue that we can actually open or talk about. Even if we go to a civil rights person to try to mediate, that civil rights person is an African American person, and we've done wrong. So it's like there's like a no-win situation where we're at. I mean, so there is a lot of resentment there. It's kind of like they're considered a minority, but yet in a roundabout way, we're the minority because we have no rights at that point.
Do you feel that do you feel, Tammy, this is resentment at you personally or at white people in general?
And white people in general for something that we've not done just because of a color of a skin color. Kind of like what you were just saying, it may have happened to two generations ago, but it's still being held over where we can't even address an issue just because of a color. You see what I'm saying? A skin color. So it's kind of like, and we're all professionals and we should be able to address this issue, but you can't. And I don't know how to get past these boundaries because like I said, there's so much anger there, and it comes down to if this person is a secretary, maybe African American, there may be a Caucasian one doing job skills. Well, this one's getting away with it because of this, or this one's getting away from it because, and it all comes down to race. It always comes down to race when it has nothing to do with that.
I wonder.
It's very frustrating.
And I'm not sure we're going to be able to help you with how to resolve this tension in your office. But I can hear your anger and your resentment. And Gregory Rodriguez, Tammy is not alone.
Well,
I understand that.
Yeah. Oh, hold on. Let's hear from Gregory.
Your first guest, Tana Turner Rice, said something really fascinating, that really we have to move beyond, I think, what she called superimposing racial biases and generalizations on individuals and start seeing people of all different types and backgrounds as individuals. When we speak in terms of race and when we speak as racial, when we say things like, as a Latino, comma, I feel, and when we get together and talk about race very hyper-consciously, I'm not sure we're moving beyond it. I think reconciliation, to the extent that it'll happen, happens as individuals mix. These people in this office may need to go out and have some drinks together, not to talk about race and the resentment for race, but they need to go maybe have a couple of drinks and play some pool and get to know each other. My point is really that I'm not sure the hyper-consciousness and putting race and speaking as a black person or a Latino person or a white person is really helping us move beyond.
Tammy, we wish you the best of luck.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's go now to Natalie. Natalie with us from St. Louis in Missouri.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi. I agree with Mr. Rodriguez, and I had that experience of moving in and getting to know people on a personal level. I relocated to St. Paul, Minnesota, and I moved in with a white woman until I got my own place. And so we had all these intimate talks. We'd go out at night and we'd come back and we'd talk about everything. And one night we had been out and I noticed there was some distance. And she said to me, I asked her what was wrong, and she said to me that until I started hanging out with her, she would have never believed that any man would prefer me because of my skin color to her. And that led to a really, really in-depth discussion about race relations, where I learned so much about her family. She had two beautiful biracial kids who didn't know their white side of their family. But during the time that I was there, they did come together. And I just will always value that experience and the fact that we were able to be so honest with each other, because she also hung out with a group of African-American men who only dated white women.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were even able to talk about that, even with some of the guys. So it was a really, really good experience. I think that when you are at work and in places of public places, there's a facade there that kind of disappears if you can go into the homes and, like Mr. Rodriguez said, go out and have a drink and take those walls down, and the communication, I think, becomes much more open. And we found out that we're more alike than different.
And nevertheless, I'm sure you also learned that, maybe not a perfect person, she was a person.
Right. Right. who had all kinds of issues. She felt like she wasn't attractive to white men. And at 18, she moved into a housing project where there were a lot of black people, and they loved her and thought she was very attractive. So it was really interesting. I will always value that time that I spent with her, and that time that I spent in Minnesota, period, because it seemed that it was a good place to openly talk about racial issues.
Interesting also that you would mention the word facade. And Gregory Rodriguez, I think Dawn Turner Trice in her segment talked about the advantage of doing this on a blog where people are anonymous or semi-anonymous. And when we're confronted with the problem of being somebody identifiable, we do mount a facade. We may not speak honestly.
Right. Right. But, you know, when you're hanging out after the dinner table, after you've been hanging out all night, you get a chance to have more intimate
exchanges. Yeah. Gregory Rodriguez?
Well, the caller says exactly what I would hope to say much better than I did, which is that friendship between individuals leads to greater racial understanding. She did get around to talking to race with her friend, but it was only after they met each other as individuals. And as long as we're keeping up this and race is one of our many identities we carry around. We have so many identities, and we don't. As your first guest said, we often assume that one acts as a black person or as a Latino or as a white. They may have been mean to you because they're jackasses. They may have had a bad day.
Right.
But we superimpose race over all else, and that doesn't help us understand them as humans and as you mentioned, as flawed individuals.
Great.
Thank you very much for the call, Natalie.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
We're talking with columnist Gregory Rodriguez of the Los Angeles Times. He's director of the California Fellows Program at the New America Foundation and author of Mongrels, Bastards, Orphans, and Vagabonds, Mexican Immigration, and the Future of Race in America. Well, the future of race in America is also what we're talking about. Have you ever spoken honestly with a person of another race about race? 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get Brenda on the line. Brenda with us from Endicott in New York.
Hi. Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
I want to write a book about this. I guess it's called Etiquette. I don't know. My African-American son is over 6 feet tall, and he's often approached and spoken to as if he plays sports, or spoken to like with kind of street language, how some white people think that all black people speak, and neither of us speak that way, at least not most of the time. And it's insulting when people, I don't know if it's a discomfort level or because maybe they don't know better, and some people, as was said earlier, some people who are unfamiliar with other cultures, they really don't know, and they're not trying to be disrespectful, but all black people do not speak, you know, a certain kind of way, and all black, young, tall black men do not play basketball. My son has never played sports a day in his life. He's a scholar and a musician. And so that's something I've always wanted to talk about or write about.
Interesting. The well-meaning and totally clueless, I would guess, Gregory Rodriguez insult.
Absolutely. I think really, but this is the way we do speak. I mean, she hits on something very important. Our newspapers, our radio, our television, our government, our political system, we do generally assume, I believe, very broadly in this country that white people are individuals. They act and speak and do as themselves. We assume that all people who are not white somehow are representatives of a collective action or feeling. And so therefore, they're always walking stereotypes.
Exactly.
And again, if we need to really get beyond this and allow everybody to be an individual, and we do not do that yet in this country.
Yet at the same time, you have other people say, wait a minute, we are collective. We are members of a group. We're an oppressed minority.
Absolutely, and this is the problem with the racial discourse we have. We feign unanimity. We feign we act. That's the way the political game is played. We're gonna say, oh, all Latinos are the same, and we're gonna rise up together. And if you don't do what we want, which is really what three people in the Beltway want, then our people will somehow act against you. But it's all a farce. But the newspapers, but the New York Times editorial board will respond and believe this is true. We're all living in this brokerage political world in which one person gets to speak for 30 million. And so, for instance, an elected official in Los Angeles, for instance, will be elected by 50,000 voters in assembly in an assembly district with too few voters. And a newspaper will call this person a Latino leader.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I mean? He's a leader of the 40,000 people, or at least the constituents within his district. But we superimpose these roles on people in a way, and it's a way of almost disenfranchising Latinos themselves to say that only their leaders matter. Because there's an assumption again. Go ahead.
Excuse me. That drives me crazy too, especially when the Reverend Wright or something comes up, and then I want to say, listen, are you with Timothy McVeigh? I mean, did you share the same Timothy McVeigh, a white male person. Come on. It's the same type of thing. And sometimes I have to bite my tongue because, you know, some people don't always, sometimes they mean well but just don't know any better. Mm. And you have to just distinguish that sometimes.
Brandon. Absolutely perfect example. Timothy McVeigh is exactly seen as an outlier. He is not seen as representative of the thinking and the behaviors of the average working or lower middle class white person. Whereas a black gang member or a Latino gang member is somehow reflective of that broader population, rather that he comes from, rather than being an aberration within that population.
Mm-hmm. Brenda, thank you so much for the call.
Thank you.
And Gregory Rodriguez, I'm going to give you 30 seconds to answer this question. I hope you can try. And that is, do you think that this is a problem that can begin to be reduced by dialogue, by process, or is this a problem that can only be reduced by attrition, if you will?
That's a great question. One, it will not be reduced by dialogue within the structures we have within the civil rights organizations, which we pointed out really have an interest in presenting a uniform front. We can't break it all down unless we almost need to break down the civil rights era infrastructure in order to get down to race on an individual level. We all live as individuals before we live as Latinos or black people or white people.
Gregory Rodriguez, a columnist for the Los Angeles Times. He joined us from the studios at Marketplace in Los Angeles. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Coming up, Kathy Kramer-Walsh studies racial dialogue. She'll tell us why they work and when they don't. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now, we're continuing our discussion on race and racial politics. Communities across the country have used dialogue in an attempt to improve race relations. Kathy Kramer-Walsh has taken a look at this strategy, observing community dialogues and interviewing participants. Her book is called Talking About Race, Community Dialogues and the Politics of Difference. She's also an associate professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin and joins us today from the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
And we also want to hear from listeners, too. Have you ever spoken honestly about race with someone of another race? Have you ever participated in a community dialogue about race? 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And you can read what other listeners have to say on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And Kathy Kramer-Walsh, who goes to these meetings?
Volunteers from communities of a variety of racial and ethnic backgrounds. And basically, these meetings are sponsored by local governments or nonprofit organizations in the community. And they ask for volunteers from all walks of life. So basically, anybody who's interested in coming to the dialogues.
So a self-selected group.
Exactly. So you're not getting the most racist people in a community, that's for sure.
And so therefore, I guess there's an element of preaching to the choir here.
Well, exactly. I mean, a lot of people criticize these dialogues for that. They say, you know, aren't you just preaching to the choir? And I asked many people running dialogue programs like this around the country how they responded to that criticism. And the best answer I got, I think the one that was most just telling of what goes on in these groups is what was from an activist in Dayton, Ohio. And she said, you know, I said, aren't these programs just preaching to the choir? And she said, well, honey, sometimes the choir needs practice. And and that rang very true for me for what I see going on in these programs, because many times – go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to say also the choirs need practice, but sometimes the choirs – I'm not sure how to extend the metaphor, but you know, there's some discordance there. People in the choirs think – hey, I'm okay, but bringing out their own racial prejudice can sometimes shock them.
Yeah, no, exactly. Many times what you get is, especially among the white folks who volunteer for these programs, they're people who are what you probably consider liberal with respect to racial tolerance, or pretty racially tolerant, pretty liberal with respect to a lot of race relations policies and civil rights policies. But they get into these dialogues and their eyes are opened very wide, and they realize that in their own daily life, they actually perpetuate certain forms of discrimination. They actually perform some types of racist acts even without knowing it, and certainly without intending to.
And sometimes, I assume, this stings.
Oh, absolutely. And so one thing that comes out in these dialogues is people tell each other their stories, and they both tell each other sort of their own perceptions of race relations in their community. But I think the things that are most powerful are the stories about what happened to me personally. And here's a story of when I went into a grocery store as an African-American man, and repeatedly this happens to me, that a white woman will hold her purse tighter to her and draw her children nearer to her just out of a base reaction of seeing me. And other whites in the group, whites in the group will look around at each other and say, oh, my goodness, I can't believe that goes on in my community. And then sometimes whites in the group will say, well, I guess maybe I've done that myself. And stories like that, when they get told, they're very eye-opening. And it may be that they're preaching to the choir. But again, the choir needs practice in the sense that if these are the folks who want to improve race relations in their community, they find out that they have quite a bit more to learn before they can actually move forward together and actually try and heal race relations right there in their own town.
Let's get Jackie on the line. Jackie's with us from Simsbury in Connecticut.
Hi. Yes, my name's Jackie. I'm actually a professor at the University of Connecticut. And I teach a course there called Human Evolution and Diversity, where we explore race from more of a biological perspective. And it's really a very science-based class, but I would like to somehow incorporate more of a discussion about race from a social perspective. And that's not really my background. My background is in science and biology. But I was wondering if maybe Ms. Walsh had any tips or what types of things I can do to foster that kind of environment that's open and would encourage discussion.
Well, that's a great question. And honestly, you're in a great place in order to do that, because the first thing I would suggest is that you get in touch with an organization called Everyday Democracy, located right there in Connecticut. And many of the dialogues that I studied across the country were assisted by this organization, formerly called the Study Circles Resource Center. And one thing that the Study Circles or Everyday Democracy folks will probably tell you is to set have your students agree on a set of ground rules. And things like, you know, listen to each other, take turns, don't monopolize discussion time. So just very common sense type of discussion rules. But then they might also help you give you a curriculum in which your students can use to sort of foster dialogue. It would be things like just certain questions to ask for the facilitators of the discussion to ask to help guide the students through talking about race, because goodness knows, it's a very difficult topic to talk about.
Anna,
right?
And there's a word there, facilitators. You need outside help, you think?
I do feel like I would benefit from the outside help because, like I said, my background is not in any kind of social science. It's really biology.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm kind of working my way through how to, as opposed to standing up there and just teaching the students, I would like to get them involved and to get them to talk to each other and to be able to benefit from learning both sides, both the biological aspect of race and our diversity and also the social aspect.
But they're so different. I mean, the scientific method is one thing, but you're asking essentially for anecdote, these people's stories, what happened to you?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, Kathy Kramer Walsh, it would be a very different kind of a class that day.
Oh, you know, it sounds pretty awesome to me. It sounds pretty fantastic. It does sound very difficult, right? And good for you for wanting to give it a go. I would say, you know, outside help might be great in the sense if you have folks who are practiced in leading discussions about race and quite honestly, there are, you'd be surprised how many people in the community have been involved in some kind of dialogue about race, who if you just maybe look around, ask the Everyday Democracy folks for some help, they can help you locate folks. But having someone come in who's skilled at leading a discussion on race could really help a lot.
Jackie, thanks very much, and good luck.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
There are some people, as I'm sure you know, Kathy Kramer Walsh, who say this kind of approach doesn't work. To try to address this at the rational level doesn't mm-hmm. get to the deeper underlying problems and grievances.
Mm-hmm. You know, honestly, I'm not quite sure how to respond to that, because one of my reactions is, if you're saying people are never honest in these discussions, you know, I can't say whether they're honest or not. How can we, you know, we can't read people's minds at this point in time. So does that mean that people are never honest with one another about how resentful they are or how hurt they are? Perhaps that's the case. But I think these discussions do work, but they don't work in the way you expect. I mean, it's not the case that people go into these discussions very resentful of one another and then come out holding hands and best friends with each other for life. That's not what happens. Instead, what happens is people go into these discussions thinking that they're going to be best friends for life in some cases, and they think that what's going to happen is they're going to see people as people and they're going to move beyond race. And I say that that as an expectation across people of people across racial backgrounds. But instead, what happens is they hear stories about discrimination and they hear stories that illuminate the very different perspectives that people of different racial backgrounds have in this country, and they're surprised and they attain a level of awareness that they wouldn't have achieved in any other part of their life without having this opportunity to talk about race across racial lines. They would never know that these differences in perspectives and histories and experiences exist. So, yeah, it's possible that people are never completely honest, whatever that means, in these discussions. But these discussions do provide people a window to the experiences of others living perhaps across the street, across town from them, that it's important to recognize before people trust one another and respect one another.
Let's get Sharon on the line. Sharon's calling us from Marietta in Georgia.
Hi.
Hi, Sharon.
Yeah, I grew up in an all-white, predominantly white high school, and I felt invisible basically all 4 years. But that was 20 years ago. Now I have a couple of close white friends, and we can talk frankly, but just in general, there's not a way. What I find is that, you know, most whites are defensive and just don't want to, you know, listen or totally understand what is actually going on.
Is she right, do you think, Kathy Kramer Walsh? Most whites are defensive?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think she mentions the key word, which is listening. I think it's only in kind of repeated sessions where people are engaging in discussion with one another, not just one time, just by chance or, you know, just for a couple hours, but over a series of weeks or months in which they come to know each other as people and attain kind of a basic level of trust, if you will, that allows them to let down their guard a bit enough to open up to say, you know, what you just said is hurtful to me, or this kind of thing happened and that hurt me in this manner. I think a lot of people are very guarded when it comes to talking about race, and it's only when you have the opportunity, the forum to open up, that kind of opening up is going to occur.
And Sharon, let me ask you, you say you have a couple of close white friends. Have you had those kinds of conversations? I can't believe you said that. How can that really hurts?
Well, we were able to just be on one accord. Like, I'll proceed something with, okay, excuse me for using this term, you know, if we're talking about someone, of a white person of low economic means or something like that. But no, I mean, when you're really comfortable with somebody, when you're really good friends, I think that, you know, when you love somebody as a true friend, it doesn't make that big a difference. But even as close as we are, you know, there are the occasional mishaps or
sure,
whatnot,
yeah.
And you either just let it go by or you might bring it up later, but it's really not that big a deal with your close friends. But it's a big difference with all the other people that you have to associate with who are at work or in your community.
Yeah. Sharon, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate the phone call. We're talking with Kathy Kramer Walsh, an associate professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin, author of Talking About Race, Community Dialogues and the Politics of Difference. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's talk with Peter. Peter's with us from Miami. Hi, Peter. Peter?
Hi.
Hi, you're on the air, Peter. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I had an argument with my wife, who is Caucasian, and I'm black. And in the argument, we were speaking, and one of the things that she said while we were arguing is, I don't know how to be black. And while we were talking about that, I told her it's not about being black. It's about being a woman, period. And I just wanted her to be a little more strong in dealing with the issue that was at hand. And by her saying that, it just offended me to the point where we're still 3 weeks later dealing with just that comment.
And this is obviously in a marriage. You must know each other pretty well.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
This is in a marriage. You must know each other pretty well.
Yes, I mean, it is in a marriage. I mean, we do know each other very well. But I felt as though what she said, just by the nature of what she said, and like I told her, if I wanted to be with a black woman, I would have been with a black woman. I want a woman, period, not just a black woman. So by her saying that, I think it was an insult to being black. And I'm black.
Misunderstandings. Thanks very much, Peter. Misunderstandings at every level, Kathy Kramer Walsh, can pop up. Even, you know, that moment of utter incomprehension. I don't know you.
That's right. That's right. Even like as a caller just showed, you know, even among people who think they know each other very well.
Let's see if we can squeeze one last caller in. This is Robert. Robert is calling us from Baltimore in Maryland.
Yeah, hi, Neil. I think it's really important that, and I'm saying this as a white male perspective from a white male, that I make an effort to put myself in situations that create discomfort. Because as a white male, I am in the most comfortable position in society. I rarely feel discomfort. And until you understand the discomfort, the fear, the anger that other races feel on a day-to-day basis, dialogue that really can't go forward. Until we start to empathize with the situation and be okay with the anger and expect that, then you can kind of move forward. And until we do that, you're not going to get by anywhere.
Is he right, Kathy Walsh?
I would disagree, but I appreciate the sentiment. But here's why I disagree, that I think there's a difference between, say, debate or discussion about, say, policy change or the type of action people want to take together. There's a difference between that and dialogue. And I think that dialogue actually is necessary in order to kind of reveal the misunderstandings that people have. I think it's absolutely necessary to have that kind of talk before you move on into some kind of collective action together. I think dialogue is necessary because those misunderstandings exist. And without
totally agreeing learning with you on the dialogue, I absolutely agree with you on the dialogue. I'm just saying that in effort to understand it and progress with the dialogue, more white males need to move beyond the let's just get along because we're all human beings and whatnot. No, this is a racially polarized nation, and mm-hmm. it was founded on racial bias, and there's still a lot of issues with the preacher situation with New Orleans. We have to deal with race in an honest way, and the only way I'm going to do that is I come out of my little white male shell, and again, I'm a white male, so I feel this, and really try to understand where all this is coming from.
And I agree with that. I think oftentimes that it's only in these discussion forums where that kind of awareness comes into play. For example, I can remember a discussion among a group of folks that was primarily African Americans from a community and white male members of the local city government. And this is in a central Wisconsin town.
Mm-hmm.
And
can you finish this in 10 seconds?
Oh, sure. And the white male members of the government, their eyes were opened very wide by the stories that they heard. They thought that they had got it. And so the dialogue enabled them to come out of their shell in a way.
Kathy Kramer Walsh, thanks very much.
Sure. Thank you.
Kathy Kramer Walsh at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. This is NPR News.